So this is a slightly different audience from the audience that I'm used to talking to, and so I was trying to decide which topics to talk about, and what I realized two things. One is that I should probably leave out pretty much all details of everything, and number two is probably talk, at least touch on a little bit, as many different things as I can. So I called this two new pieces of the puzzle, but actually there are several more additional parts to this talk. So without further ado, let me talk about how we as theoretical chemists think about controlling chemical reactions. And we think in terms of the Born-Oppenheimer picture, where we have a ground potential energy surface and an excited potential energy surface. And imagine that we have an ultra-fast laser pulse, which excites a nuclear vibrational wave packet from the ground potential to an excited potential. And that will now execute some type of wave packet evolution on the excited state potential. And if we want to break a particular chemical bond, let's say in a triatomic molecule, so one coordinate here is the AB coordinate, one is the BC coordinate. If we want to break off C from AB, then we wait for the wave packet to be at a certain place in both position and momentum space, and come in with a second pulse, and bring the wave packet back down to the ground state surface, and it'll go out and break off C. If we want to break the other bond, then we wait for the wave packet to come back to a different region in phase space. And then we come in with a second pulse, bring the wave packet down, and it will come out and break off A. Okay, and this is work that goes back to the mid-1980s in collaboration with our chairman. And this is the formal mathematics for optimizing the laser pulses, which will steer the wave packet out of one channel or out of the other channel, is given by this set of coupled equations. Again, I don't want to go into any detail, but these equations have been used, I would say, in hundreds of articles. Hirsch-Rabitz is really the first who wrote down this form of equations in 88, and we worked on this from 85 to 89. You have five coupled equations, the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, where the Hamiltonian depends on the electric field, which you can control. You have to formulate mathematically what is your physical objective, and we like to formulate it in terms of a projection operator, which projects for the chemical arrangement channel that we would like to break off A or to break off C, and this is the wave function on the ground state surface at the final time, and we're interested in the final time goes to infinity. And then we have a formula for the optimal electric field, which involves some overlaps between the wave packet on the ground state surface and a dual wave function on the excited state surface and a similar second term like that. These equations have to be solved iteratively, and in practice they're solved by propagating forward under some guess for the electric field, applying the projection operator to get the dual wave function, propagating backwards, and then doing this iteratively until the field that you use for the propagation forwards and backwards generates wave functions and dual wave functions that when substituted in here give back that field. So this is a quick review of many years of work and applications. And I want to talk about where things have gone more recently. Starting in the mid-1990s or so, it became possible to make ultra-fast shaped laser pulses by taking an unshaped pulse, dispersing it in frequency, sending it through an array, a liquid crystal display, and shaping individually all the amplitudes and phases of the different frequencies, then recombining all these frequencies together to get a desired shaped laser pulse. And this now makes the idea of optimizing a laser pulse something which can be done actually very, in principle, very easily now in the laboratory. And so one of the issues that the field has been concerned with for the last 10 years, I would say, is that we get out from numerical simulations and also from experiment many complicated shaped laser pulses, but we don't know what their mechanism is or what they're doing. And if you try to visualize, here's a simple example, if you try to visualize one of these pulses in the frequency domain, you have an envelope that looks like this and a phase profile that looks like this. If you Fourier transform that in the time domain, it looks like two pulses with a phase profile that looks like this. And these are related by a Fourier transform. But to try to understand the mechanism, it's useful to think about these pulses in a time frequency phase space. So the pulse that I showed a moment ago has two pulses in the time domain. So you can see that here in the phase space. But in the frequency domain, you can see that if I compress the two pulses in time, I have a single envelope in frequency. So this is the Wigner representation, which I think many of you are familiar with. In the context of quantum mechanics, but it's useful also here for the time frequency representation, where time and frequency are conjugate variables. And there's the Husseini representation, which again many of you are familiar with. In the Wigner representation, you have these interference terms. In the Husseini representation, these are not present. We decided to choose a third representation, which is less familiar. It's known as the von Neumann representation, and it's a time frequency representation or a position momentum representation in which the phase space is discretized. And the way the representation works is that you divide the phase space into cells of area 2 pi if it's time frequency, of Planck's constant if it's quantum mechanics, and in every cell you place down a Gaussian. And then one can prove that those Gaussians are a basis which is complete but not overcomplete. And the motivation for using this basis of Gaussians, if you think back to the first slide that I showed you, we had a mechanism where we excited with a short laser pulse, and then if we extend that mechanism a little bit more, we can excite again with a second laser pulse, wave packet will propagate, and then de-excite with a third laser pulse. So to a kind of a zeroth order approximation, the mechanistic interpretation of many of these optimal control pulses is a series of Gaussian, ultra-short Gaussian pulses. So decomposing the laser pulse in terms of a Gaussian basis seems to make a lot of intuitive sense. And if we have three Gaussians here, then in this von Neumann representation, then the pulse is just represented by three pixels. So it's a very economical and intuitive representation for these types of mechanisms. And together with our experimental collaborator, Tobias Brixner and his group in Würzburg, there have been several applications of this, experimental applications to this. One is to explore the fitness landscape. So for instance, if I think that I'm looking for a mechanism of two ultra-fast pulses, I can see what's the effect on my yield of adding some additional pulses in the vicinity of these two. And so Brixner and his group are able to scan very efficiently, both in phase and in intensity, in the omega t plane using this representation. Okay. A second application is to use this von Neumann representation as a way of representing the pulse in the context of evolutionary algorithms. In evolutionary algorithms, what one does is one takes an entire generation of, let's say, 50 of these pulses, and takes segments from pairs of them, and does crossbreeding, and makes a whole new generation of pulses. And now this representation of the pulse corresponds to fundamental mechanistic building blocks. So if we take a pair of pulses and we take parts of them from one and parts from another and intersperse them, we're getting a very intuitive way of making a new generation of pulses. And these pulses can be simulated using a very small number of parameters. You just need some parameters to specify the location in time frequency space. and then the amplitude and the phase. And so this is an example in which the evolutionary algorithm is applied to with this target pulse, and this von Neumann representation gives a very fast convergence, much faster than one gets using some other representations of the pulse. And here's a third application. If we do an optimization, we get a very complicated pulse, we may want to distill out what's the fundamental mechanism. So what we do is we remove the parts, the pixels, that have the smallest coefficients until we're left with things that have less and less, smaller and smaller coefficients. And so here's how this works in practice. Here's using 121 basis functions. And we clean the pulse by taking away the ones with the smallest coefficients. And we're able to get rid of here about 80% of the parameters of the pulses, and until finally the objective significantly decreases. So this is a very useful representation in terms of cleaning pulses and trying to understand their mechanism. Okay. And what happened to us was that we had developed this representation in time and frequency, but then we found out that it was actually useful for quantum mechanics in position and momentum representation, and also in signal and image. I want to show you some examples of that now. So there is something called the correspondence principle, which says that if I understand the classical phase space, I can use that in principle to understand the quantum mechanics and to figure out what are the important parts of the quantum mechanical calculation. So here's the classical phase space corresponding to the Coulomb potential. And the phase space extends out to very large x, and it goes up to very large p at small x. If I were to try to use a Fourier representation to describe the phase space here, I would have to use a rectangular representation. But even though the important region is just given by this region in red, so all of the blue part here is essentially wasted area in a typical type of calculation. What we do is we use this phase space representation. Here's a sample two-dimensional potential. And if we use a Fourier representation, the error starts to rise significantly at this point. We're able to get down to about 1/10 the number of basis functions by sampling, putting down basis functions only where they're needed based on the classical phase space. So it seems to be a very, very efficient representation for solving the time-independent Schrodinger equation. More recently, we've applied this representation to solve the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And in particular, we're interested in the electron dynamics in the presence of attosecond pulses. So here is a Coulomb potential. This is, so far, it's a one-dimensional calculation with a soft core. And we have here an XUV pulse, which is attosecond, and a near IR pulse. And here's what happens in time-dependently in terms of the phase space. So the electronic distribution starts off in something which is very similar to the ground state of the Coulomb potential. The red is showing you the larger coefficients. And as the pulse comes in, this is the evolution of the phase space distribution. And you can see what this is showing is that we're able to place down basis functions only where they're needed. These are predicted based on classical mechanics, and they do a very good job of describing where the quantum mechanical wave function is going to go. Now, in one dimension, we save here about a factor of 10. But if we go to multidimensional calculations, we expect to save more than a factor of 10, an additional factor of 10 per dimension. And so where we're headed with this is we want to actually look now at multi-electron problems, in particular the helium atom, with two electrons in strong fields and trying to control them using shaped attosecond laser pulses. This shows that we're able to get extremely high accuracy with this method. This is the full calculation is shown here in red. and the reduced calculation using only 1/10 of the number of basis functions is shown here in blue. There's a small discrepancy here, and that discrepancy is coming from not from the numerical method, but from the filtering of the wave function around momentum equal to zero, filtering out the bound state. So it's not connected to the numerical method itself. And this shows that we're able to get down to about 10% of the basis set size in one dimension and still keep an error of about 10 to the minus 8. I want to turn to the second new piece of the puzzle, which is the reconstruction of the excited state wave function and excited state potential of a reacting molecule by CAR spectroscopy. And the reason this is important is that if we try to design laser pulses to control chemical bond breakage, one of the major impediments is that we don't generally know the excited state potentials very accurately. So there's a lot of guesswork. If we could know the excited state potentials very accurately, we could predict in advance the shape of the laser pulses we need to control the bond breakage. And this method that I'm about to show you actually will give us information about exactly the parts of the excited state potential that are important for the bond breaking process that we're interested in. So the main features of the method is that here's a ground state potential. I'm showing pictures for one dimension, but the method is general for any number of dimensions for polyatomic molecules and for dissociative as well as bound state systems. So here's the ground state potential. We assume that that's known, and therefore we can calculate all the eigenfunctions of the ground state potential. We assume that the excited state potential, shown here in red, is unknown, and that's what we have to recover. And our strategy is to represent the wave packet moving on the excited state potential as a linear combination of the ground state eigenfunctions, where all of the time dependence is in the coefficients. The formula for the coefficients is given by the overlap of the ground state eigenfunctions with the moving wave packet on the excited state, and that can be written, this is the evolution operator on the initial state. So the coefficients take the form of a wave packet cross-correlation function. And what we were able to show is that cross-correlation function can be extracted from a femtosecond CARS experiment. So here's the simulated femtosecond CARS experiment. You start at time zero with the wave function in the ground state. A short pulse comes in and transfers the wave packet to an excited electronic state. That starts to move. That's the first order wave function that we're trying to reconstruct at time t. But in the CARS experiment, a second pulse comes in and brings that back down to the ground state where the wave packet continues to evolve. And a third pulse comes in, brings that up to the excited state again where it continues to move. The measured CARS signal, if it's measured with heterodyne detection, is the overlap of psi 3 transition dipole moment and psi 0. So this is a measurable quantity. And from this quantity, we want to extract the first-order wave function. And from that, we can get the excited state potential as well. So here's how we think about the CARS. Here's how we think about the CARS signal. You have the wave function here, moves upstairs with the transition dipole moment, propagates on the excited state surface. Second interaction with the transition dipole moment, and then it propagates on the ground state surface. And then the third interaction with the transition dipole moment propagates on the excited state potential again, and then overlap that with the transition dipole moment and the ground state, and that gives us the CARS signal as a function of three time delays. And the basic idea is that this intermediate propagation on the ground state surface, what we can do is we can insert a complete set of ground state eigenfunctions here, which we assume are known, and then we've represented the CARS signal in terms of these cross-correlation functions, which are the coefficients that we need. So essentially, the square root of the CARS signal gives us the coefficients that we need for the time-dependent coefficients of the moving wave packet. Once we have the moving wave packet, and we have Schrodinger's equation, we can invert Schrodinger's equation to get out the excited state potential. So it's simple algebra to show the excited state potential. Once you know the moving wave packet, you know the kinetic energy operator. You have the wave packet at two different times. You can calculate by finite difference d by dt, and therefore you can calculate the excited state potential. So let me show you some results from this. This is for bound lithium 2, and taking the wave packet at different instants in time, we construct the potential locally where the wave packet is large, and we put together all the pieces, and we get a very nice reconstruction of the excited state potential. The method works also for dissociative potentials. So we take the wave packet at different times, splice together the regions of the potential where the wave packet goes, and we get an accurate excited state potential for dissociative systems as well. The method is general for polyatomics, and this is where it's really significant for controlling chemical bond breakage. So if we consider, let's say, the water potential, we have two bond coordinates, so R1 is here and R2 is here. This is the ground state potential, that's the excited state potential. And we're going to consider H2O and also HOD. H2O is symmetric and HOD is asymmetric. So here are the eigenstates of H2O, which you can see have symmetry with respect to reflection around this axis. Here are the eigenstates for HOD, where the symmetry is broken because the masses are different. These are the ground state eigenfunctions. And now, using these eigenfunctions, we're able to reconstruct the time evolution. Here's 0 femtoseconds, 2 femtoseconds, 4 femtoseconds, 7, 10, 13. We're reconstructing the excited state wave packet motion. And here's HOD, where you can see, obviously, it's the evolution is asymmetric. And from the wave functions, we're able to reconstruct the potential. So this is the reconstructed potential. That's the exact potential. And you can see they're very similar. The potential gets reconstructed in the regions where the wave packet visits. So it's getting reconstructed at further and further distances as time goes on. And the ratio between these two is very close to 1, showing that it's very accurate. This is H2O, which is symmetric, and this is HOD, which is asymmetric. But again, the accuracy is very satisfying. So this is a summary of this part of the talk. This method applies to polyatomics as well as diatomics, to dissociative as well as bound potentials. From the reconstructed wave packet, we can obtain the multidimensional excited state potential energy surface, which has been a long-sought goal in theoretical chemistry. And this is of great interest in quantum control of chemical reactions, because it allows us to design laser pulses to control the outcome of chemical reactions once we know the excited state potential surface. I want to touch on a couple of other topics of a more numerical nature. This is work with my graduate student, Ruven Eitan. What you see here is the Krotov method has become a very popular method for solving the optimal control equations numerically. And this is the convergence as a function of the iteration number, shown here in red. This is the BFGS method, shown here in green. And the green method is better than the Krotov method at long iterations. What Ruven was able to do was to find a method which combines the best of the Krotov and the BFGS, shown here in blue, so that it rises as fast as the Krotov at early times, but it's better than the Krotov at late times and better than the BFGS method at late times. He's also found a way, in principle, to eliminate the need for forward-backward propagation in the optimal control equations. We call it the telescoped Krotov method. And he can do a simple forward iteration for these equations. There's a variation on this method that he's developed where instead of having just one dual or adjoint wave function, he has two of them. And then he can actually choose in any way he likes the equation of motion for the second adjoint equation. And this gives him a lot of flexibility, allows him to handle optimal control in the presence of absorbing boundary conditions, and therefore to work very efficiently on a small region. So here's the Krotov method, and here's the telescope Krotov method, which rises a little bit slower at the beginning, but goes higher and involves only forward iteration. I want to spend the last couple of minutes talking about a question here that my interest got kindled by work of Herschel Rabbits and co-workers. Herschel and co-workers had a paper in the mid-2000s which said that if you look at the optimal control landscape, which is the objective as a function of the control variable, so in principle if I discretize my laser pulse, this is a 1,000 by 1,000 landscape, that they're the only allowed maxima have value 1 if it's a controllable process. There are no maxima that are suboptimal. This would be a landscape corresponding to suboptimal maxima, where you see some maxima that have values below 1. And in some of the more recent work of Herschel Rabbits and co-workers, the problem is formulated in the following way, that the proof is based on a chain rule, that the derivative, the functional derivative of the objective with respect to the control field is given by the chain rule as the functional derivative of the objective with respect to all unitary transformations, and then the functional derivative of the unitary transformations with respect to the control field. This object is fairly well understood, and it's known not to have any false maxima. It has saddle points, and even that's well known, how many saddle points it has, but it has no false maxima. And therefore, for this to have no false maxima, one needs to know that this visualized as a matrix is a full rank. And that full rank assumption turns out to be non-trivial. I can't say that we have found examples of true traps, but what we have found are a wide class of problems where you have what we define as second order traps, which means that in any direction that you go, the Hessian is negative definite, so that you have places where or negative semi-definite. In other words, it doesn't go up. It goes either down or it's zero. And this is a very broad class of problems that have that feature. You have a three-level system, or it could be larger, where 1 is coupled to 3 and 3 is coupled to 2, but 1 is not directly coupled to 2. And under a wide class of conditions here, one can show that there are second-order traps. The existence of traps, even though they may be isolated and they may be few, their importance is that there's a basin of attraction associated with them. So it doesn't necessarily matter how many there are or whether they're isolated, because there's a whole region in which nearby trajectories will climb to that maximum and not get to the global maximum. Okay. This shows some simulations where this parameter is the control field amplitude, and this shows the number of failed runs. As the control field has a large amplitude, the number of failed runs goes to zero. But for weak amplitude, we have quite a few runs that fail to find the global maximum and get stuck at some other point. So even if the true traps may not exist in practice, one can have numerical difficulties associated with this region around weak fields. So here's an overall summary. I've talked about two new additions to the dream of controlling chemical reactions with laser pulses. One of them is to visualize these pulses using a time frequency representation and to understand their mechanism. And the other is to reconstruct excited state potential energy surfaces and excited state wave packets in the region that's important for this control. And the von Neumann representation should help us understand the mechanisms. Reconstructing the excited state wave packets and potentials should allow ab initio studies of laser selective chemistry. And then technologically, we're in the coming years, we're expecting a new generation of broadband light sources where shaping in the ultraviolet will become possible. And we expect that this technological improvement, together with these new pieces of the puzzle, may help us to see many examples of controlling chemical bond breakage. Thank you.
David, that was a very nice talk. I just wanted to make one remark. I agree. I think most of the traps, there will be second-order traps, and probably for the calculations, those second-order traps are actually more important because even if they're not complete traps, they have a base enough attraction. Although there was one example in that preprint that Pierre did that is undeniably a proper trap because the Hessian is like positive. It has the right definiteness. It is not semi-definite. So there is at least one example. It's very constructed, and I think most of the traps that are actually relevant in the simulations are second-order traps, but at least they do exist. Mm-hmm. Although, yes, I know you can argue maybe there's not very many of these, so that was one comment I wanted to make. Also, it's very interesting. So you said when you had very low control field amplitudes, all of the fields didn't, you had a very low failure rate.
A large number of failed runs.
We actually have an opposite regime for another application where when you make the control amplitude too large, suddenly all of the runs get stuck. So there really seem to be sweet spots in the control space where you're unlikely to get stuck. But if you're in the wrong region, then the problem gets hard and you are likely to get stuck. And so I think there's a lot of questions still what the landscape is globally. That was, sorry, just what I wanted to add.
I have two questions. One, David here. One relating the reconstructing of the wave packets. How far does it depend on the temperature being zero, so having a well-defined initial state? And the second question relates to the von Neumann representation. I didn't quite get how you actually choose the part of the phase space that you need to sample. So maybe you could explain that a little bit more, and maybe even draw a comparison to the mapped Fourier grid, where you adapt the Fourier grid to the potential.
Right, okay. So with the... The first question was about the wave packet reconstruction. Right? Just say it again.
Whether you need zero temperature.
Yeah. Okay. We haven't tried any simulations with finite temperature, but I think that's a secondary issue here because because vibrational temperatures are usually very fairly low. In other words, there is some contribution from V equal one and V equal two, and it's true that can have an effect. But it's also not that's relatively easy to cool the vibrations. And for heavy things like iodine, V equal one, V equal two, I know are important. For lighter systems, it's terribly important. All right. So this is the second question. How does it compare to the mapped Fourier? The mapped Fourier actually has difficulty right around the origin, and this is something that we didn't know till we really tried it and saw that we weren't getting very accurate results. It reshapes the phase space to the point where you get this very sharp needle which can lead to numerical error. But it's more than that because you have a single global mapping. And so for the example that we showed here, in fact, Norio chose this example precisely because it's difficult to do with the mapped Fourier. There was a near IR pulse and there was an XUV pulse. And what that does is it gives you fingers of the wave packet in phase space that are located in different regions. So a mapping that might be good for one of them wouldn't be good for the other. in general, the mapped Fourier method, we used it for time-dependent calculations. But unless your wave packet stays in a kind of stays as a kind of a localized object, then it's difficult for the single mapping to really work for everything together. So we use, basically, we use, so for the time independent, we use the classical phase space boundary, and then we still have to do a little bit of extra work, but that's for a longer discussion. For the time dependent, right now, for the attosecond work, you can get a very good approximation by just using the classical mechanics, even without including the Coulomb potential in there. And but there's another method which we've tried, but we haven't done too much with it yet, which is where you have a boundary and you monitor the coefficients of the basis functions on the edge. As they start to grow, you add more and more. People have done that in other contexts. So for an unknown, for a problem which is completely unknown, you may want to do it that way.
Hi, over to your right. That was a really nice introduction for those of us who are not so initiated in the field. I had a comparatively very naive question. Very early in the talk, you showed a simultaneous Fourier and time domain representation of one of your pulses, and I think you said you didn't quite understand why these particular pulse shapes are what comes out of the optimization. I first wanted to ask the question of what were the units on, you didn't have any dimensions, just said phase
and
I was struck by the fact that it kind of looks like the control propagator for Carpersell, right?
It looks like?
The control propagator for Carpersell. It looks like you have pulses where you have a phase step, and if the phase is stepping by pi, then it looks like a spin echo sequence.
Oh, those pulses, that was just a simple example. But these pulses normally that come out of the optimization have many, many tens of oscillations. And so that was just to kind of motivate things about a joint time frequency representation. But normally the things that come out of both the experiment and the calculations have many, many tens of rapid oscillations.
They have some periodicity or structure that's regular?
This is an open question in the field. So a couple of things are useful. One is to try to filter out what are the important parts of the pulse. And so many people have worked on that, including people in this room, but the method that I showed here with the phase space representation is a way which could be useful to filter out the important parts. The other thing is to kind of mechanistically test which are the important parts. Okay. So you're here at least for this week, right? So those should have some discussions about this.
I'd like to make some comments about the landscape analysis. I'll talk about it further tomorrow, but let me just give you some background. Some of you don't know about this. I mean, this was generated based on observations in the literature by many people, including many in this room, about the ease of doing optimal control calculations, and then the experiments mounted, not necessarily perfectly, but quite reasonably well. And this is not a theory. It really is more like a mathematical theorem because it rests on assumptions, three assumptions, and it's very important that they be stated. And one is the system's controllable, two, this so-called full rank condition, or it's called surjectivity condition, and secondly, that there are no constraints on the controls, and these are strong statements. But it mathematically follows from what physical observables look like. In fact, it's true classically as well that there should be no traps in the landscape under these assumptions, the satisfaction of these assumptions. So the proof's in the pudding. And those of you in the room here who do OCT calculations, optimal control calculations, and don't constrain the controls, and the issue of the amplitude is only one variable out of many, and when it is very dangerous to look at what one parameter does. Those of you who do calculations, if you're running into traps and you first of all haven't constrained the resources, then okay, then you found a violation of one of the assumptions. And this is why this was developed, to see what is the explanation for the ease of finding solutions. If there's an alternative explanation for that, of course, we'd love to hear it. And just as a comment, tomorrow I will go into further details on this.
So a couple of comments about that. One, I have personally a problem with the local surjectivity assumption, because if I look at that assumption geometrically, it's the assumption that I have no maxima in the second factor, and so in a way it's building that assumption is already part of the thing that I'm trying to prove.
It's an assumption that says that for a differential change in the state, there's a differential change in the control that corresponds to it. And immediately, that plus the other two assumptions lead to this conclusion. And you can't violate the assumption and draw the conclusion, for sure. And any of the three conclusions would break this. And that one, too.
Delta U delta E is not allowed to be zero. Is saying that delta U delta E can't have a...
It can be zero at any point, but it's a function of time. It has to be a linearly independent set of functions over time. Whether it's zero or not at some point doesn't matter.
Right, but that means that I can make a linear combination of them if it's not full rank, which is zero, and therefore.
But not zero for all time, not for a finite set of functions.
Not for all time.
That's correct. The issue is it has to be zero for all time, which is an extremely demanding condition, highly unlikely to be true.